Yeah, so first rule of our discussion, we've all become really good friends in getting this together. Come join us. Don't feel like you gotta sit in the back. This is gonna be, I keep saying this when people look at me funny all day, this is gonna be a really casual, friendly discussion. This isn't gonna be super clinical or, like, scary. So everybody come join us. We're gonna have a whole lot more fun if you're up close. Because, you know, it's the end of day 3, 4, whatever day we're on. And,
so
you know,
a friendly discussion on sexual assault.
Exactly. A friendly, open, loving discussion. If you've been to other stuff today, we're all exhausted. This has been 3 days of mind-blowing, awesome knowledge. So we're going to just take it easy and have a good chat. I have a script I'm supposed to read, so give me just a second while I find it. Okay. Thank you for attending Session 368, titled Start by Believing, Preventing Sexual Assault and Supporting Survivors in the Mormon Community. Before we begin, we ask that you turn off cell phones. Come on down. We ask that you turn off your cell phones and that everybody here is going to be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. I have a mic I should be using. Sorry. Please keep in mind, when engaging in the Q&A portion, which is going to be at the end of the session, following the remarks of our presenters, those who cannot abide by the guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please take advantage of our Sunstone Symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing the Skullcandy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session will be 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and attendees, we ask that immediately after your session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin for the next session. Our panelists today are April Carlson, Catherine Jones Porter, Donna Kelly, Deanne Tilton, and Saria, I've never actually heard your name pronounced.
Thank you, Kathy.
You want to say that in the microphone?
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. and I'm Aubrey Parmenter, and we'll be discussing ways in which communities can work safely to prevent the sexual assault and skillfully to support survivors in healing. I'm the moderator. We're going to be, do we have enough time to read everybody's bios? I think we do. April is a licensed clinical social worker, and she earned her master's in social work from the University of Southern California and her bachelor's from the University of California, Berkeley. She recently shifted from investigating and treating child sexual abuse to providing grief and trauma support to cancer patients and their family. Catherine Jones uses her background as a secondary survivor of sexual assault to fuel her passion to educate the masses about rape culture, myths, and the true definition of consent. Any opportunity to empower and educate women is an opportunity she jumps at. Donna Kelly has worked as a prosecutor for the last 22 years, devoting much of her time to working with victims of sex crimes. For the last 10 years, she has worked in Utah County, where she has prosecuted some high-profile cases. Deanne Tilton is a survivor activist and founder of the nonprofit organization Talk to a Survivor. During the 2015 and 2016 Utah legislative sessions, Deanne and other survivors successfully lobbied to expand the time limits adult survivors of child sexual abuse have to bring a civil case against their abusers. Yes, clap for that, please. Sarita, and I'm still trying to learn your last name.
Venkatapathy,
thank you, is a survivor advocate and yoga and wellness business owner who focuses on healing and community in her yoga studios, nonprofits, and outreach. Her work focuses on self-care and well-being for those with mental illness, trauma, and in need of coping skills for life and stress. All right, so we're going to go ahead and get started, and then we'll open up for Q&A, hopefully when we've got about 10 minutes left. I'm just going to over here. Does everybody have access to a microphone? We're going to pass along.
We
need to speak into microphones because it's being recorded. Oh. So we're going to have to pass. Why don't we put the middle microphone there, kind of in between you three, and we'll kind of share this one.
Okay.
So I know we wanted to start off with a couple definitions. So let's start there, defining a little bit about what we're going to be talking about. So you said you wanted to use the CDC definitions. Do you want to explain a little bit?
Sure. So the definitions of sexual assault, for example, do we want to throw out what the words? So I've looked at sexual violence also historically, and it's fascinating. But the current definitions, the definition of what is sexual violence continues to evolve. And luckily, unfortunately for our society, it continues to expand and sort of cast a wider and wider net around different behaviors. So, you know, in the past it was, you know, a penis going into a vagina of someone that didn't want that to happen. And it was like that for a long time. Now, you know, the latest definitions of this, according to the CDC, are broken down into unwanted contact sexual experience and unwanted non-contact sexual experiences. So those non-contact sexual experiences include things like voyeurism, exposure to pornography, exhibitionism. You know, that counts. That's sexual violence. So pretty much anything that you can think of that is unwanted by one person that is perpetrated by another person, that is sexual in nature, it all counts. So
let's talk about sexual abuse, because we're going to cover that too. April, I know you had a definition that you wanted to share with that one, maybe.
I did. So with sexual abuse, that it can certainly be the types of contact that we've already discussed, but that it's really important that we look at the exposure that all genders have to sexual assault, that especially within the Mormon community, we're more likely to report and know of sexual assault that happens to women when there's physical violence involved, there's forms of sexual abuse that are seen as more acceptable than others, that we can talk about it, we're okay, we're comfortable seeing somebody as a victim, versus you know, the missionary who's sexually assaulted by his mission companion. He's not here on this panel today because he's not comfortable sharing his story. And I know he's not the only missionary who was raped by a mission companion. So that as we think about sexual abuse, that we think about the people who are not here today.
Catherine, do you want to talk about defining consent?
Okay, so one of the huge things that we kind of in this community have been working towards is shifting the wording that we're using. So instead of saying no means no, that puts a lot of pressure and a lot of responsibility on our survivors. Whereas if we turn around and we say yes means yes, the only thing that means yes, is an enthusiastic yes. We said on our podcast, a hell yes and a high five, continued consent. If you say yes in the beginning and then decide a little bit later on as things are getting all hot and heavy that you don't wanna do this, you can say no and that counts. It's making sure that people realize that you need to be communicating with the person that you're being intimate with, whether it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, one night stand, or even your spouse, your partner, your long-term partner, acknowledging that any type of physical, intimate, you know, experience that you're going to have with one another, both parties are equally as involved, invested, and excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Perfect, thank you. So, on the topic of,
we'll get this.
So, on the topic of consent, I want to talk a little bit about how consent is or isn't present within LDS circles, and I'd like to talk about how we can teach consent and early consent messaging, which is a concept that is just vital.
Who wants to buy have some thoughts on this.
Sarita has thoughts.
I do have some thoughts. So a lot of my work around activism with sexual abuse and sexual assault and any kind of sexual violence I'm really flattered to be among these ladies, because a lot of my work is not so much on the professional side, but on the more social and cultural sides, the interactions that I have day to day with, whether it be my yoga students or the people that I interact with, the difficult conversations that I have. And so one of the struggles at times is to discuss what have been seen as gray areas. And we have a culture in the United States that has a very Puritan background. We have a very set group of beliefs, a set cultural ideal about what makes someone innocent and what makes someone guilty. And I think everyone in this room can recognize that there are times and many discussions where the need for blame is such a heavy, there's such a heavy impetus for the need for blame. And it's difficult to assign guilt in these situations. We want to find an understanding of this is to blame, or this circumstance, or this was what occurred. And with sexual violence, it's so much harder to pull out the pieces that are Puritan values that give us false ideas about who is to blame. A rapist is to blame for rape. And certainly, rape is not a legal term. Rape is a term that's used socially and culturally. And sexual assault is our legal term that we use. But when we're talking about the implications of the patterns that we teach about modesty in the Mormon culture, the implications of the patterns that we teach at young ages in the way that we expect children to interact with maybe a priesthood leader, maybe a relative or a family member, the expectations of what the family implications are and what that relationship should be can undermine the idea of consent for that child.
Perfect. So I handed out a couple of handouts as people came in. I hope everybody can have access to one at least, but you or your neighbor had one. At the top, this is put out by the Utah Health Department, a fairly conservative, very data, very research-based group. And at the top, it sort of gave a summary of the state of affairs in Utah. This was distributed in February of this year. I was at the news conference supporting them when they released these numbers. But Utah is one of the worst states in the United States of America for sexual assault, both sexual assault and domestic violence. And there are, I after working in this field for a very long time, since 1990, I've been in a special victims prosecutor, prosecuted domestic violence, sexual assault. There are many contributing factors. One of them is we have a natural tendency to always want to find blame for the victim. As I was sitting and getting ready for this session, I just was reading the Huffington Post. Yesterday there was an article from a Mormon victim who, and it now is in the Washington Post as of yesterday, she was given a date rape drug and raped, and her bishop put her through a disciplinary council. She got pregnant from the assault, and her bishop put her through a disciplinary council, and by a very slim margin, she was not excommunicated. Mm. But the fact that she had to go to a disciplinary council when she was given a date rape drug, which is somewhat rare, you know, among sexual assaults. I mean, this is the kind of thing that is happening to victims. And when they come forward, they oftentimes get blamed for their assault. Another thing that happens, I think, especially in Mormon culture, is we don't want to really believe that this happens. This is Zion. All is well in Zion. We don't want to do anything to disparage our, you know, rosy image of Zion, right? So we don't talk about it. Whenever I tell people Utah is one of the worst states in the United States for sexual assault and domestic violence, mostly their reaction is disbelief. Oh no, I don't think that's right. That can't possibly be right. I know lots of women, and none of them say they were sexually assaulted. And I'm like, yeah, because we don't talk about it. it's also a very much a defense mechanism. Sexual assault is a violent, horrible crime. It has severe damaging effects. I mean, it's just a very horrendous crime. And so to make ourselves feel safer, it's a defense mechanism. To make ourselves feel safer, we want to say, oh no, this doesn't happen here. Oh, she said she was raped. Maybe it was just a misunderstanding. Maybe it was, she gave the wrong signals. We try to find ways to explain it away because that makes us feel safer. If we can say to ourselves, sexual assault really doesn't happen here, we feel safer, we feel like our daughters will be safer, we feel like everything's okay, and it really is just an illusion. So to me, that's not a good way to deal with the problem, is to ignore it and deny that it's happening.
Donna, you bring up a...
Pass the mic game. Donna, you bring up an excellent point. One of the things that we've talked about as a group is how to make our communities feel safer. I think that any of us who have been through any kind of sexual assault or victim situation want to make that move from victim to survivor. And we were saying just before we got started, those of us who've been there can walk into a room and know immediately whether or not we're going to be in a safe place or whether we're going to be, maybe not able to really fully express ourselves and what we have to say. So what are some things that we can do as faith communities or amongst our friends or in our families? What are some things that we can do to sort of make it a safer place? I think a great place to start would be, how do you receive a disclosure? Catherine, I saw your hand.
Oh, well, I'm actually going to leave Deanne that one because she might know a thing or two. But one thing that I wanted to just touch on, and I'm sure that we'll get back to, is one of the ways that we can make our community safer is to be talking about this with our children. Like, talk to one another, talk to our sisters, talk to our brothers, talk to our parents. You know, take the stigma and like the uncomfortableness that is talking about sex and really like talking about consensual sex first. Take that away, remove that, and be teaching our children about what consent means. Whether it's, you know, we can talk about, and consent doesn't have to be sexualized when you're talking to an 8-year-old or when you're talking to a 3-year-old. You know, you're on the teeter-totter, and one of you wants to get off of the teeter-totter. You need to let that person get off of the teeter-totter, because if both of you aren't having fun and both of you aren't saying yes, it's not fun for anybody. It's not right. And it's simple things like that, and it's instilling those ideas in the minds of our kids. They're going to grow up having these really excellent consensual interactions with people, whether it's sexually based or otherwise. And I think that in and of itself is going to help breed a community where we can talk about things, where, you know, we as advocates, we as survivors, we as community members, we can't stop rape. The only people who can stop rape are rapists. They are the ones who are causing it. They're the ones who can stop it. But what we can do is we can provide a safer environment for our survivors by making them comfortable enough with talking to us about it, with them being able to know, like we were talking about, you know, walking into a room and saying, like, I can be precisely who I am here. I can talk about my experience here, and nobody's going to look at me and say, are you sure? Are you sure that's what happened? I've seen how you guys interact before. I've seen you flirt with him, or I've seen you flirt with her before. Are you sure that's what happened? We need to make our community a Start by Believing community, and that's where I'll hand it off to Dia.
So, safe disclosures, or, you know, so where do I want to start? End Violence Against Women International created a public awareness campaign a few years ago called Start by Believing, and it was really intended to prepare all of us to be ready with a safe, supportive response when someone discloses that they experience some form of unwanted sexual experience. And so, Utah last year became a Start By Believing state. I believe this started with Heather Stringfellow seeing this with Planned Parenthood and then kicked it over to Angela Romero. I point out these names because this is all community. No one does this on their own. We all help each other. So then Angela Romero ran the piece of legislation and Governor Herbert signed this proclamation making Utah Start By Believing state. We're one of four now. So it's like Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and us. We're all connected. So hopefully we're getting more states that say, hey, we have a Start By Believing day. So
This is the Start By Believing resolution.
Yes. You can go to startbybelieving.org and learn all about it. But basically, it's this. Practice and memorize a few phrases. First of all, wrap your head around, and I think we're all preaching to the choir here, but you're going to get disclosures if you haven't already. And the people that will disclose to you, the people that are going to disclose are going to go to the people they love and trust first and feel closest to, family, friends, that they feel that they might get a supportive response. So that's us, and we want to be prepared with a few quick phrases that encourage them to get the help they need, and if that includes reporting it to law enforcement, that can ideally prevent more assaults. So,
can we practice this?
Yeah, let's do it.
What are some good phrases?
I believe you.
Everybody with me?
I believe you.
My favorite, and it's kind of a strange one, is that makes me sad, or that makes me confused, or I don't know what to say to you right now. Can I think about it and get back to you?
That's a lot of
I mean, you don't have to memorize.
I'll get back to you.
Why don't we do, that makes me so sad.
Oh.
Yeah. That makes me so sad.
I'm sorry that happened. What can I do to help?
I'm sorry that happened. What can I do to help?
I would add to Donna's, what can I do to help you feel safe?
What can I do to help you feel safe?
I believe you.
I would throw out one.
What happened was not your fault.
What happened was not your fault.
I'm trying to think of all the best responses I've had in my disclosures. One of the best answers was, I can't understand completely, but I will always try.
I can't understand completely, but I will always try.
Those are great, you guys.
I would just want to add one of the first disclosures that I received was from a Black roommate in college. And because the people who investigated the rape were of a different race, she was very uncomfortable. And it was something that I hadn't considered. I didn't consider her experiences with law enforcement in the past as not being safe people. And so it was very traumatizing for her that the police officers that, you know, came and swabbed everything in the room and investigated the assault were all white. And you know, if I, grown up me, who's not a freshman in college, could go back in time, you know, I would say, hey, like, let's see, like, what friends of hers does she feel especially safe with? You know, maybe we could start with the person from the rape clinic who met us in the hospital. Maybe we could start with her and see if she can help us identify somebody within law enforcement who's tasked with responding to sexual assault. So it's not just the beat police officer who doesn't have a lot of experience. Things that I could have done that would have made that disclosure for her easier.
Less scary.
And I think that weaves so well into the concept of understanding and developing more context for the intersectional issues that we need to address within the patriarchal systems in different cultures, and how that affects victims, what their ideas about themselves and who they should be are, and how those beliefs can be shattered by an unwanted sexual experience.
Can you give an example?
So what brought that thought up to my mind is that I had a very similar experience in my freshman year of college and spoke to the young lady and I felt powerfully compelled. I just thought, you know, and I was a survivor at this time and in some ways was still in a place of insensitive and not very healed state of mind because I felt powerfully compelled to basically force her to report. And that was disregarding consent. And I continuously put pressure on her to report and to report and to report. And I had previously not reported. I had my own struggles and memories and fractured and broken ideas about my own legacy with sexual abuse. And I did not take into consideration that she was Latina and that she had a really different experience with who in that community she would report to. We went to school in Greeley, Colorado, where there is a very interesting demographic and a great deal of racial tension because of the demographic of specifically Muslim people that work in the slaughterhouse and the stockyards in the beef industry there. And she was very well aware of the cultural implications and the bad side of town and the college side of town. And so she felt that she had to keep this image of who she was as a college student. She had to keep this image of who she was a successful Latina woman. Mm-hmm. She was not one of the Mexicans from the other side of 8th Street kind of thing. And certainly she had her own concerns and issues and dysfunctional beliefs about who she was and what she needed to be, but those were culturally informed. She had a desire to be a successful college student. She was a first generation college student.
Yeah, I think considering the many forms of oppression on a person who's already been victimized, just how many layers of oppression do they already have on them, and a lot of this is about power. Specifically, sexual violence is about, you know, feeling entitled to have a sexual interaction in a situation you can control. That's what it really comes down to. Whether the person is, you know, I'm physically smaller or I'm developmentally less developed or I have a job that's less important than the other person, a lot of this comes down to it's okay to get my sexual desires met if I, you know, can, in a situation I can control with someone who's less powerful than me. So the more layers of oppression that victim has, the harder it often is for them to disclose, which is different than reporting. We often talk about reporting when you get law enforcement involved, and disclosing, just someone is telling you, and it could be anything from just saying like, yeah, I'm a survivor of sexual violence. And that's a disclosure, and leaving it at that. And I wanted to touch on, you know, as an organization, we get disclosures. I get disclosures all the time, every day, at least once a day. And I always try to honor that. It may be something that, often it's said as sort of an aside, we're chatting, and then it's like, well, you know, I'm a survivor too. And then they move on. And I always want to just say like, thank you for sharing that with me. And, you know, how painful.
I can vouch for that. The first time that I met Deanne, she did that too. It was at our podcast with John DeLynn back in May. And she's really good about that. And that's another way I think that all of us can help to make people feel safe. When we talk about this and when we talk about these issues, you will have people saying things like, yeah, I was sexually abused as a child. Or, oh, well, I was raped in college. You know, those things come out. It's one way that we can help each other feel safer is to look at each other in the eye and say, I'm sorry that happened to you. You know, and just acknowledge. Mm-hmm. Part of being human is to love other people and to acknowledge and help other people heal from pain. I mean, that's the human family. So
I wanted to address things that make it easier for perpetrators to perpetrate.
Yes, please.
So individuals, we exist within the larger context of a family, a community, a society. And in our daily interactions, when when someone's looking to perpetrate, because I've interviewed a lot of perpetrators, what they're looking for is someone with poor boundaries, where they physically move into your space and you're a child or you're an adult, you're a human who wants to be nice and doesn't feel comfortable saying, hey, you're standing too close to me. People who ask intrusive questions. When I hear all the time in the Mormon community, one person asking another person about their plans for how many children they'll have, if they'll continue to have children. You're asking somebody about their sex life, about their fertility, their family planning. I might be asking those questions just out of cluelessness, but another person who does have the desire to exert power over someone in a sexually assaultive manner, they ask those kinds of questions to tell them if this is a person that I can take advantage of. Perpetrators who perpetrate on young children are always going to befriend the people in authority first. So they're friends with the parents, and they establish a good relationship with the parents. So the parents trust them and allow them access to the children. In a singles ward, the perpetrator is friends with the bishop. He's in good with the people in authority, so they have a positive relationship with them, and it makes it easier for them to violate others' boundaries because they're in with the right people. Things that we can do to strengthen our community so that perpetrators aren't as successful in causing harm is to really empower the voice of everyone. You know, I taught Sunbeams and, teaching three-year-olds to be able to say, yes, I want more goldfish crackers. No, I do not want more goldfish crackers. I am tired. I don't feel good sitting here in this sharing time exercise for, an hour after having spent an hour in Sunday school or sacrament meeting. It's making sure that we're creating a climate where people can talk about what's happening in their bodies and that's not shamed. It's when your children, you catch them masturbating for the first time. How do you handle that? Is it, hey, that's something that we do in the bathroom or in your bedroom. It's not okay to do that in the middle of your second grade classroom or your primary classroom or at the dinner table, that feels good. And it's nice to touch our bodies and to feel good, but that's something you do in private in your own space, and making sure that we're comfortable from very young ages being able to set these boundaries and not just constantly giving out the lists of don't do this, don't do that, all the no instructions, but also giving yes instructions of these are the ways that that it's nice to have a body and to feel things and to share with other people, and creating safety as we model in equal relationships between men and women, men and men, women and women, that we ask for permission, that we give consent, that we share power. Inequality creates the circumstances for sexual abuse and sexual assault to happen.
So one of the things that's, I think, so powerful about the Start By Believing concept is that we need to allow victims to be heard. There's a saying that, in the criminal justice world anyway, that minutes of skillful support by someone who cares and is compassionate immediately after a disclosure is worth hundreds of hours of professional counseling later.
So true.
So the first person that comes to you, the first person that person goes to, if your reaction is, well, why did you go over to that house at 11:30? What did you think was going to happen?
Right.
What kind of dress were you wearing? All of those kind of questions, that can cause tremendous damage to that person, and it can prevent them from going forward in the criminal justice system with their case. I've probably worked in a rough estimate about 3,000 victims over my 26 years of handling these cases. And some of the victims who were the most successful did not wind up with convictions or even prosecutions.
I took a case to trial once when I was prosecuting in Oregon with a victim who came forward and reported her uncle for rape. And it was a difficult case because it was a 10-year delayed report, and you know, the longer a case gets as a prosecutor, the longer the case gets, the more difficult it is. But we went to trial, he was found not guilty. And so I was devastated, she was devastated, we both went home that night, and the next morning I came to my office and there were flowers in my office for me. And they were from her, and the card said, "You believed me, and that's enough." And I went on, I stayed in contact with her for probably about 10 years. She went on to go to college, get married. She was a happy, successful person. So this start by believing concept, if we can get other people to do this, to be able to do this, you can make the difference in someone's life by how you respond to sexual assault. You can make the difference. Are they gonna go on and have a happy, successful, you know, relationships, happy life? Or are they gonna forever, because of what you said, not go forward, not tell anyone else, and feel shamed? You know, that can make a difference. So the Start By Believing program is incredibly powerful.
I just was thinking with these ladies and their amazing thoughts and contributions. This cultural struggles that I see that we have within the Mormon context oftentimes can be boiled down to misunderstanding the concept of assertiveness and misunderstanding the concept of grooming. So we were talking about behaviors that are preparing, you know, people that are singling out people with poor boundaries. They're singling out people who are vulnerable to these sorts of manipulation. Those are grooming behaviors. And those are things that we need to nip in the bud, really. And there are a lot of times in our church culture where we encourage those behaviors unintentionally because we're advocating for, you know, forgiveness, the innocence of this person, or assume the best. And while I think all of us on this panel have understood and had so many implications in our life, and there's a power in forgiveness even of those who have abused us, we also understand that giving the message of forgiveness to a survivor, especially a recent victim, is damaging, just like the Start By Believing concept. If you start with the concept of forgiveness, if you start with the concept of a disciplinary council, the message is it isn't centered on the well-being and the recent trauma of the victim. And then the other side is the assertiveness that we teach, especially children, young women, and young men in those programs within the Mormon church specifically. So there are many contexts, and of course my context was with the young women's program, where I felt frustrated and sometimes ashamed of the programs that I was participating in, and I had leadership roles, and found myself extremely frustrated because I was a go-getter and confident, and came from a family with parents who always encouraged me to speak my mind and voice my thoughts, and gave me this confidence to not be afraid. Should one of the best examples was when a bishop said, you know, as a president of a Laurel class for the 16 to 18-year-old girls in the Young Women's Program in the Mormon Church, those are the Laurels, and I was asked to be the president of the class and was asked to choose a presidency. And I said I wanted my first counselor to be a friend who was not very active in the church, and they came back to me and said, "No, I think you probably need someone who can be a better right-hand man." And I said, "No, like, that was my revelation. That was my speaking from God." And so I was very fortunate to be raised in a family with parents who taught me appropriate boundaries and a good and appropriate level of assertiveness. But I think we do a great disservice in our programs in the primary program of the church and in the young men's and young women's programs of the church by glazing over the importance of being assertive, the importance of asserting your needs, and the importance of being able to say no.
Yeah. Oh. I just want to weigh in just briefly.
not passing the mic. But one of the things that I've been thinking as I'm listening to all of this, we have a tendency within faith, Donna, we've talked about it before, but there's kind of a generation gap. There was a pretty awful book that was passed around that basically the teaching that came out of it was, if you didn't fight to the point of death, it's your own fault. And that is complete and utter garbage.
You should rather lose your life than your virtue.
Exactly. And
that's what we were talking
about. I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but I know even, 18 years ago, that was still being taught. And I know I internalized that a lot. And when I
was taught that as well by a mother who's a sexual assault survivor.
Yep.
And that was the instructions we received in our household.
Right. So I want to just right here, right now, if any of that is a voice that still plays in any of your heads, or that you may have found yourself judging others, even if you, because we're human, we judge, erase that. That is completely patently false. Even if it was consensual for a second and then you said, no, please stop, you are not responsible for anything that happened to you. You are not responsible for the choice that somebody else made to assert themselves and their wants over your own. And if there's one takeaway that we can have, I hope we have multiple from today, but if there's one we can take away from this, I want everybody to know that it's okay to stand up in Relief Society or Young Women's or against your visiting teachers or your home teachers and push back on that and say, we need to teach in our faith that it is okay to accept and love and forgive, but it is more important that when somebody is hurting, we mourn with them. So if something happened to you, or if somebody's coming to you with something that happened to them, it is not their fault. And that's something that needs to change teaching-wise.
There's so much that's intertwined with all of this, with sexual violence, but with the, it's better to be dead than not be a virgin, right? Isn't that what it's saying? So, again, I look back
it's
to...
It's your fault if you didn't fight to the death.
There's that, which disregards everything we know about the neurobiology of trauma and freezing. So someone who's had an experience of, had a traumatic, violent experience growing up, whether it was sexual or otherwise, they're much more likely, if they are victimized again, to go into freeze. And that's a biological, they have no control over whether or not they freeze. And of course that looks like, well, you must have wanted it back in the day. Now we know better. But I want to touch on virginity for a moment, and going back into history from biblical days and through the centuries, the value of purity and sort of the pure vessel or the pure womb of females actually is about controlling, once again, control. It's about controlling reproduction. So back in the day, a daughter was owned, was property of her father's, and the daughter needed to stay a virgin so that prospective husbands knew that the seed that they would implant and then work to provide for was actually their own seed. And so this really goes back to propagation of the species, and it's very basic stuff. So fast forward to today, and we still have these thoughts that, a woman's womb needs to stay pure. I guess I just want people to think about the origins of that. And women are entitled to their own sexual lives, their own bodies, their own sexual experiences. This is not about being a virgin and having no worth or less worth because your womb has had other seed.
You are not a chewed up stick of gum or a lick
right,
of
right.
duct tape that's been on every arm.
Oh, jeez.
So we really need to separate women's entitlement to their own bodies and sexuality and women's worth only if they haven't had sex yet. It gets all tangled up with consent or, rape. And it's just, those two things need to be separated.
Perfect. Thanks. We've got about 4 more minutes before we open for questions.
all of our topics are so big, it takes a long
time. I'd like to talk a little bit about prevention.
Yes.
Because I work so much with child sexual abuse, what I've seen over and over again is that children have relationships with the people who abuse them. 75% of survivors are assaulted or molested by somebody who's known to them. 1 in 10, it's somebody in their family. So when we look at prosecution and trying to hold someone accountable for this crime that occurred, often what that means is taking away a family member or a friend and incarcerating them. I had a 5-year-old boy testify, you know, was in court to testify, and his 16-year-old perpetrator, who had brutally sodomized him over many months, was there. And my client, he just wanted to say hello to his perpetrator and see how he was doing, because that was his friend who played with him. And, you know, inside that child, he held both someone who'd caused him incredible harm, but also somebody who was a friend to him and somebody he had a relationship with. And so when we wait until after the fact to address it, until after the assault has happened, after the abuse has happened, there's already so much damage there. There's no way we can repair those relationships for the survivor. What we can do at an institutional level, we could be one of most Christian faiths that requires background checks for all adults interacting with children. An adult should never be alone with a child as a coach, as a volunteer, as a primary teacher, without having had a background check. A bishop should not be the first person to explain to a 12-year-old what it means to masturbate, what it means to pet someone. You know, like these weird terms that we use within our faith, and we've institutionally created a context where people can abuse power. And so we're not safe. Our children are not safe. Our youth are not safe. The individual reporting domestic violence, they're not safe because the person receiving the disclosure doesn't have any training, and they may be actually perpetrating, even if, there's a lot that we can be doing, a lot that we could be demanding from our institutions, from our culture, from our church that would protect, that we're not doing yet.
And I think we can start in these things by making decisions in those situations, making decisions to have the courage to speak to our leaders, to confront and to have opinions that we express, even if we experience resistance, which oftentimes we do. It takes a great deal of courage to dissent. And I'd also like to note, in an audience like this where most of us have probably been survivors, been secondary survivors, or we've known someone, that we are not entitled, as I told my earlier story about trying to help my friend report, that was not my place to do. And so it's really important in these times and in these situations to cater to the needs, the wants, the desires, and the time frame of the survivor.
So really quick, before we open it up for questions, Deanne is going to talk a little bit about the Start By Believing pledge, and then we'll go ahead and open the floor.
Raise up hands, who lives in Utah? Who doesn't live in Utah? Okay. Hey, thanks for coming to Utah. So those that don't live in Utah, if you're interested, you might consider trying to help get a Start By Believing your state to be a Start By Believing state. Go to the website, startbybelieving.org, look at the legislature, it's great. Come up afterward and I can give you some ideas. But in the meantime, Talk to a Survivor moderates a Facebook page called Start By Believing Utah, and then it's like education. There's another one, but don't be confused. You'll see it. So there are a lot of people taking pledges. The Start By Believing pledge, a video of them, including our own mayor, Jackie Buskupski, who identified as a survivor. She took her pledge in May, I think. But John DeLynn, Lindsay Hanson Park, we've got just lots of folks taking the pledge, and it really does help grow, change the what we think is normal. What's the normal way to respond to someone if they say this has happened, whether they're saying something that happened 50 years ago or 50 hours ago. So let me just read the pledge to you, and we go something like this. My name is, and then it's blank. My name is Deanne Tilton, and I go in and try to humanize myself. Like, I'm a mom, and I'm a founder of Talk to a Survivor. I'm a sister. I'm a best friend. Whatever hats you wear in the community. And when someone tells me they were raped or sexually assaulted, I start by believing. So that's the verbiage. It's really easy to take the pledge. I go around in the community and have people take pledges and then put them on that Facebook page. You can be whatever business you belong to. You can help make that business a Start by Believing business. You can be a Start by Believing school. You can be a Start by Believing family.
You can be a Start by Believing church.
Yes.
Well,
Start by Believing
one. If you are in a leadership position in your wards, this is an excellent thing to start doing. You know, there are no major religions who are Start by Believing faiths, and the LDS
Yay.
Church has a great opportunity for super good PR. If enough of us ask, maybe it'll go up the chain.
You can take these postcards, take one with you if you want, and kind of share this idea with folks. We brought Spotlight, the movie Spotlight. Who has seen Spotlight? Oscar award winning, about the Boston Globe, uncovering Catholic priest abuse. We brought Spotlight to the library downtown as Start by Believing's first official event. We did pledges there. You can take this with you and share the idea. We'll have that
here afterwards if you guys want to, probably right outside.
If you guys want to, yeah, take a pledge. We'd love to get your pledge. And, sticker. We only have a few of these left, but what a fantastic idea. Start by Believing, bumper stickers, and also, like,
computer.
It basically is code for folks. Once enough people know what this is, that, you know, that you're a
safe person
to disclose to. Thank you. Is there any questions? Awesome.
Oh.
Yay. All right, I'm going to come to you guys.
Thank you. I'm terrible with names. White shirt.
April.
Thank you. You said you work with children, and I have this question going over my head, so maybe you can help me answer it. So I have three small children, and we have the regular... this is about prevention, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We have the regular good touch, bad touch conversations and no secrets and the kind of things you tell your kids because you want to keep an open dialogue. But I'm always worried about walking that line where they believe people are good and they believe the world is good, and I don't want to cross this line to let them know yet how bad it can be. Like, I don't want to scare them or make them think that people are evil or, you know. So do you have any good resources for helping children understand so that they, you know what I'm saying? Like, any good books or any good resources for walking that line with children?
Yeah, I do. I think I've got one here that I can pull up for you, maybe. But I would say just in your interactions with your children, when you play with your children, so much is just communication, children being comfortable taking turns, being able to say no, being able to say yes, that I don't think you need to tell them that, you know, potentially in our family someone could be a perpetrator who is grooming you to molest you.
Yeah.
The things you can do as a parent to protect are making sure that that your children aren't isolated, that you aren't leaving them alone with people who then have the opportunity to cause harm if they wanted to. I had a little boy who, a foster child I worked with, who, you know, a neighbor was super friendly and let him come over to play computer games. And this was a child, though, who had a good attachment to the foster parent he lived with, was very comfortable being open in his communication with her. And so when that neighbor whose house he went to started sharing pornography with him on the computer,
suggesting that maybe they would want to show their private parts to each other. You know, like right away, he was able to come forward and say, hey, this guy did this and said this, and I didn't feel good. I didn't like it when he did that. And then adults were able to intervene and take the appropriate action to be able to keep that child safe.
And just quickly on that topic, as someone who, I was victimized the first time when I was 12 years old, I think the most powerful tool you can give your children in preventing any sort of sexual violence or exposure to things of that nature is to lead by example in teaching them an emotional IQ or emotional literacy about their own inner feelings, and giving them time and space to reflect on those feelings, because they have more insights than you can possibly imagine about things like that, and giving them validation for listening to those feelings is important.
Okay. Do this
group.
Oh, are we near your finger?
Yes. Oh, why? Okay, nice. So we talked about the movie Spotlight a little bit, and I think it's important to be optimistic about the ways that LDS culture can change, but also realistic about what it is now and what the state is now. And I think twofold. I think I know that there is a lot of harboring of perpetrators within the LDS church. My mom prosecuted cases in Utah County, and in Utah County, most often members of the church or bishops, et cetera, come to testify for the perpetrator at sentencings instead of the victim, or I think never. You never had a case where a
never
bishop...
Not once did a bishop come
and speak for the victim of sexual assault. So it's an institutionalized system that actually protects the perpetrators and says, they're a great guy, they're in charge of Boy Scouts, they mow people's lawns, like, don't send them to jail. And so, like, that's not just happenstance, like, that's an institutional response to the situation, really focused on forgiveness. But I also think this forgiveness concept is used in institutional system of grooming, where there's not only harboring the perpetrators, but also the institution of Mormonism grooms people for sexual assault. And so I think there are lots of things. I want to hear what you have to say or what you think about it. But to me, that is total deference to people in authority. Secrets are part of the religion, particularly women, in deference to figures of authority, this concept of forgiveness. So it's actually, I think, the Mormon church grooms victims of sexual assault as an institution.
So a story I shared that was one of the more recent disclosures I've received of sexual abuse. It was a cancer patient who was dying of an HPV-related cancer. And in the course of our interaction, she disclosed that her exposure to HPV came from the heroes in her life who had molested her as a child. Mm-hmm. And so she had been molested by several Mormon leaders in her life. This is, you know, just... the epitome of Mormonness is this woman, lives in Utah, well, lived in Utah Valley, she's since passed, but wouldn't dream of reporting any of these people because they were her heroes, and it wasn't right for her to harm people's faith by letting them know that these people that were trusted in the community were causing harm. So there's a lot that we need to change culture-wise, when I think of her, you know, that she was never comfortable or in a safe space where she felt like she could tell on those people who I'm certain had more victims than her. And then thinking about something like HPV, there's a vaccination for that now. But within our religious community, are we comfortable accepting that some of our children might need to be vaccinated, not just because, you know, we want them to have a healthy sex life with however many partners they choose to have, but that they could be assaulted, and whether the consequences of that assault are one day death by cancer because, you know, we felt like, oh, HPV, I don't want to give my child permission with this vaccine to go out and have sex. But there's a lot we need to confront as a people.
And I'd like to...
We need to stop punishing victims once they come forward. We need to quit. If a sexual assault victim comes forward, they shouldn't face a disciplinary council for making out with someone or going over to their house too late. The same is true of any honor code violations. My very strong opinion is they need immunity from any sort of consequence from being expelled from a university because they were sexually assaulted.
The issue of the Mormon culture fostering sexual assault. So this touches based on what you were saying about your kids and how can you increase the likelihood that they can grow up with their sexual boundaries intact or other boundaries intact. This is not an issue of blind trust. This should not be about people trying to guess who might and who might not and who's safe and who's not safe. This is about behavior. This isn't about labels. So kids raised to just be able to look at people's behavior and feel how they feel about other people's behavior on them, and especially girls, is this wanted by me? Do I want this? How do I feel about this? Because there's so much, you know, in all these levels of all of the cultures that they operate in that tell them to adapt, to make do, to put up with, to tolerate. And to combat that, they need, is this wanted by me? How do I feel about this? And to be able to speak up. So those two things. That's it.
Oh, perfect.
I have a book for you, The Sex Wise Parent.
And a very touching book by Jan Hickman.
Thank you. We're out of time, so this is going to have to be our last question. I think most of us will probably be available if you have further questions. But here.
So I'll keep my question pretty brief. A friend came to me and disclosed that she was sexually assaulted and let me know that a roommate in my program that I'm studying was a witness of the sexual assault and was complicit and did not do anything. And so she's told me not to tell the person, and I respect that, but I feel very, and I don't have the right to feel vengeance, but I do feel vengeance towards this person that I know that's in my program that was complicit and is active LDS and now getting married. So I guess my question is how do I deal with that? Again, helping her, being an advocate for my friend, but also I feel like this friend is not being held accountable for being complicit. I don't know if that's too complex, but yeah, thank you.
I think that gets right at the heart of a point that probably all of us understand on a very deep level, and is a great question. So I would like to say that one of the most powerful things you can do as an ally to your friend is, it sounds to me like start by believing is not a new concept to you. And also, so that is a huge step. That was huge for her. And when it comes to resolving your own feelings as a secondary survivor, it's really important for you to understand that you are also, you're a secondary survivor. That does not mean that your feelings and issues and the cognitive dissonance that comes with the experience of sexual abuse your experience is null and void because it didn't actually happen to you. You are still a survivor of this experience, and so your feelings and concerns matter. And you are entitled to reach out to and find the resources wherever they may lie, which I always advocate for counseling, but I always advocate for being very careful in shopping around for a counselor who is sensitive to these issues and shares
trauma
these ideals.
Trauma-aware
counselors. If you find counselors that specialize in these areas and use keywords like trauma aware, you'll have a better chance of finding success with that. And I encourage you to go out and seek out resources for yourself, because that sense of vengeance is common in secondary survivors. It's common to feel a sense of anger and frustration and a desire even to become violent towards that person. And you're entitled to your self-care as well. The only caution I would really say about that is don't let it become about you, or don't let her become your sounding board for that anger and frustration.
One more thing, and let's talk afterwards because I have some resources that I would love to talk to you about. And secondary survivors, she hit the nail on the head there. There are resources. There are incredible resources for secondary survivors here in Salt Lake City. The Rape Recovery Center, they're trauma-informed, and they would love to talk. So as far as your question and answering that for you, unfortunately, you can't say anything. You can't approach that person, you know, it's, that's going to be a difficult thing for you to deal with. And so I definitely, I recommend talking to somebody who's going to help you navigate through those feelings. And we'll chat. And I'm excited about that. But thank you for believing. Thank you, everybody, for coming. If you have any further questions, we'll be here.
Yeah, take the pledge.
And take the pledge. We'll be in the hall.